100,000 years ago, it found its way into our galaxy. Trapped in the frozen wasteland of Antarctica, it could not escape. Now the men of Station 4 have made a monumental discovery. An alien creature had frozen, but not to death. And man...
It isn't Bennix!
...is the warmest place to hide.
And welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me to do a commentary track for one of the greatest films ever made, John Carpenter's The Thing, on the occasion of its 40th anniversary in 1982, is my pal, returning guest, and best-selling author, not necessarily in that order, Aaron Entrada Kelly. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you so much for joining me here on Outpost 31. This is very exciting.
It is. It's very exciting. I love this film, as you know. So I'm thrilled to be watching it together with you right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the very first time that we met, somehow The Thing came up and we discovered, you mentioned to me how much you love that movie. And I was like, oh my God, I do too. It's one of my favorite films of all time. And then I thought, well, I want to cover it when it turns 40. But that was like a couple of years ago. And I'm like, well, we'll worry about it when 2022 rolls around. That's far off in the future. Well, here we are. It's 2022. The movie turns 40 this year. It came out in June of 1982. And, you know, look, The Thing has been an often commented on movie. There is a commentary track by John Carpenter and Kurt Russell on the Blu-ray, and there's an alternate commentary track by some other people. There was my pal Harper Harris did The Thing Minute podcast, of which I was a guest for a week, where he examines the film minute by minute. That was a great show. If you're a fan of The Thing, you should absolutely check that show out. It's still available. So The Thing has been talked about a lot. But I think, like, if you're a musician and you hear a song that you really love, like, you cover it. You kind of, that's like your way of paying tribute to this thing that you love. And to me, that's how I talk about movies that I love, is doing my own commentary tracks for them. So hopefully... those of you out there listening to this will enjoy Aaron and my commentary over this movie again. There's lots and lots to say about this movie, and we're going to get to it in a moment. So, Aaron, if you're ready, we will count down, and we will just get rolling.
I'm ready. And I mean, let's be honest. Do people want to hear John Carpenter and Kurt Russell, or do they want to hear us? I think they want to hear us. I mean...
Unlike Carpenter and Russell, we will not be lighting any cigarettes during the commentary track. You hear a lot of that in that comment. Oh, at least I won't be lighting any cigarettes.
No, I will not be lighting any cigarettes. Right, maybe if I had candy cigarettes.
Yeah, very cool.
In the spirit of the 80s.
That's right.
All right.
So, all right, we're going to count down, everybody. And when I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, go. And when I say go, if you are watching the movie along with us, you will hit play when we say go. And of course, there's only one cut of this movie. There's some alternate scenes, but we'll talk about that as we go along. But there's only really one cut of this movie, the original cut. So I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, go. Aaron and I will go, and then everyone else can listen along. So, all right, everybody. So, Aaron, if you're ready, I will count down. And so we'll do 3, 2, 1, go. Okay. So as we're getting into like the copyright notices here, Aaron, I was too young to have seen this movie in the theater. I was 11 when this came out. And while my dad took my sister and I to see lots of movies, we would not have gone to see this. So, you know, that means you would have been even younger. So when did you first see this movie?
I first saw this movie, you know, probably in my 20s or 30s, like not until way later. So that would have been around the time I first saw it. You know, I've always been a fan of horror movies since I was a kid, but this one didn't come across my radar until, you know, I was already in adulthood.
Now, did you come to it with any sense of that it was what it was? Because, like, you know, because of course, famously, this movie was not a hit. It was not the disaster that legend has, you know, built up around it, but it was not a hit by any stretch of the imagination. And it was only over time that its legend built up. So by the time you got to it, it was a famously great movie. Did you come into it with that? Did you know, like, here, oh, this is a classic, you got to see it?
I knew it was a classic, and I knew it was John Carpenter, and that was enough. I had no idea what it was about. I had no background. So that's how I came into it.
Had you seen the original, the 50s one?
No, and I still haven't, actually.
Okay, wow, okay, all right. How familiar were you with John Carpenter at that point?
I was pretty familiar with John Carpenter. I mean, obviously Halloween, you know, which I don't know what it is about that movie, about the first one, but, you know, I've watched horror movies for my whole life. It's my favorite genre, and that one freaks me out more than any other one. I don't know if it's the music. I don't know what it is. I really don't, but it makes me very unsettled. So I assumed rightly that this was going to be just as good, if not better.
Yeah, I saw this on cable. I would have been probably 12 or 13 when it came to cable. As I've mentioned on other episodes of Film and Water, when it's been relevant, like my parents got a, here's the spaceship. Here's the spaceship. Do you ever get the spaceship the way it's toggling here? In your estimation, do you think, is it that it's crashing or that it's just landing?
I think it's crashing.
Crashing.
What do you think?
It's, yeah, the way it's sort of spinning a little out of control. I always got the sense that, yeah, they didn't intend to land. It didn't intend to land on Earth. It just sort of did. Now, here's the opening credits. This title sequence is, of course, the exact same title sequence from the 50s version.
Yes,
Carpenter,
that's what I love.
Borrowing, yes. It's apparently some garbage bags with some lit on fire by kerosene, and then they shoot fire through it. So here we go, Antarctica winter.
Oh, that's awesome.
1982. So I saw this movie on cable, on the Prism channel. They ran movies back in those days. There weren't as many movies to run. So that when they found something they could run, they ran it, you know, like every day. And I saw it then, and I just thought, oh my Lord, this thing is just, it scared me. It was gross. It was funny. It was tough. And I loved it, you know, right from the get-go, right from like 12 or 13 years old. And then I kind of forgot about it because, you know, I moved away and I didn't have cable and I just sort of forgot about it. And then in the late 90s, when I bought my first DVD player, I was like, well, I got to have some DVDs to watch. There's no point just having a player. And so I went over to this was back when like good Circuit City was a thing. And I looked at what was available and there I saw The Thing. I was like, oh, I haven't seen The Thing in so long. And so The Thing is the first ever DVD that I bought. And it was so fun to watch. And since then, I have now seen this movie hundreds of times, probably, at this point. My fiance Kelly loves it. We watch it all the time. Ironically enough, it's a movie that we put on to go to sleep to, which sounds like an insult. But there's something so soothing about the soundtrack from Ennio Morricone and John Carpenter that it's just very, very soothing. So we put it on and it lulls us to sleep in a kind of gentle way.
Are you telling me the score is soothing to you or the dial?
Bum, bum.
Do you put the dial?
Bum, bum. No, we hear the dialogue, but there's something about that opening, the bum, 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 bum of it. It's just very soothing for whatever reason. It puts it every time.
Okay.
Every time we're tired and we're like, oh, let's put something on. How about The Thing? And then boom, go to sleep.
Wow. You know what? Because I find it so the opposite of soothing.
Okay, the heartbeat of it is just creepy.
Yes, I find it. I love it. I mean, I absolutely love it. But to me, it feels unsettling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd probably have nightmares if I fell asleep to that.
I mean, there's parts of it where if we wake up in the middle and you hear the dogs being ripped apart, then it's like, oh, this isn't fun to sleep to. But we never hardly get that far. And of course, the soundtrack was so good that Quentin Tarantino borrowed parts of it for The Hateful Eight. Which, you know, you don't see a lot of movies where they purposely take movies from music from other movies, but he liked it so much that part of the soundtrack is used in that movie. So here we got the guy trying to shoot at the dog, of course, and we're seeing the setup here of like, okay, where the hell is this the style. Here were some of our actors. Think about how little there must have been for these guys to do.
I know.
1982.
I know. And there's something about, isn't there just something so compelling about a desolate setting,
yeah,
you know, that's isolated? I'm always into that. And then look at this chess wizard.
Look at this. I mean, here's our hero.
Do you think that back then, I mean, this was 1982, so people were probably like, wow, that is so cool.
Yeah.
That chess wizard game, you know? look how high tech that is.
Yeah,
know?
Wow. That's and he's about to ruin it. Now, of course, this is the only woman that will be in this movie is the voice of the chess game, which is Adrienne Barbeau, which is the great actress Adrienne Barbeau. You know, Carpenter was in a relationship with her at this point, I believe, and they, of course, she had been in his movie The Fog and Escape from New York, so they had a long... Here we go. Now she's gonna destroy the chess game. Wow. That's kind of really committing to the bit, McCready. I mean,
what are you going to do for the rest of your time?
Yeah.
And can we just note that that's the only woman in the film, and
yep,
she wins the chess game.
Yep.
So checkmate.
That's it.
Take from that what you will, listeners.
I love the idea that even among this desolate spot, McCready still has to be kind of by himself. Even he's not social with the rest of them.
Oh, he's such a great character.
This poor dog. Well, not the poor dog. We know what's, but it seems like it's a poor dog. He's being hunted by this helicopter. Look at that. Like, I don't even, how do you even build this? How do you get all this stuff out there and build generator? I don't, you know, like, my
it
God.
Seems like a lot.
Yeah.
It does seem like a lot. And look at this little, you know,
this little hut that he's
Jack. Yeah, this little hut.
And we never.
I think it's smart. It's good too that he drinks through the entire film, because that's really and before he takes up the helicopter later, he's like drinking this Jim Beam.
Yep. We never learn what they're doing out here, which is great. We don't need to know. But what is it that they're studying? Like, what? Why do you need all the? You know, what do some of these guys do? Some of them. I mean, okay, McCready's a chopper pilot. Okay, we know we need him. There's a doctor. We know why we have a doctor. Gary's in charge. But some of these other guys, like, what does Childs do? Like, what is his specialty that they need him out in the middle of nowhere here? Here, this guy's going to...
Sciencey stuff.
And start throwing some grenades at this poor dog. Again, poor dog.
Now, here's a question. Other than Cujo, what other movie are you hoping the dog dies? Like, usually you don't want the dog to die.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's a testament to this movie that I hate movies with violence to animals. It just really bothers me. I'm to the point now where I don't even want to see animals in movies, because I'm just like, you know, that animal doesn't want to be there. You know, that dog does not want to be on a movie set. It's not, and I feel very like we shouldn't even be forcing animals to do things like that. But it's a testament to this movie that it has a scene of such extreme violence towards dogs, and I can tolerate it because this movie is so good. Oh, here we go. Now the dog is already making friends. I love this guy's visors with the little slit. That looks so cool.
Yeah,
it looks
cool.
So neat. This idiot's going to try and dig the grenade out of the snow. Well, that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Okay.
It would be helpful if they spoke Norwegian.
Yes, it would.
Moment, but
look at that guy. He's licking Bennings' face. Like, oh, there we go. Now he just starts hearing shooting. Boom! There we go. He gets Bennings in the leg. Dog takes off. I like everybody scrambles. Here we go. Donald Moffat is Gary's is shattering the glass. I hope they have replacement glass.
I know. It's going to get cold. It's cold. It's cold out there.
In case
you didn't know, Antarctica.
There you go. Boom! Right in the eye. I love this little twitch right there. I love that little twitch of the death nerve, as it was. There we go. That's great. Here we go. George, you okay? So we got to talk about this cast as they roll on. So this right here, of course, the guy getting shot, that's Bennings, played by Peter Maloney. This is something I'm going to be obsessed with throughout this film, is the ages of these actors.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's a thing that we talk about where people used to look older back then,
yes,
than they do now. And so, like, you think about Christopher Reeve when he played Superman, he was 25. He was 25.
Oh, wow.
When he was Superman. I still believed in Santa when I was 25. So Peter Maloney here as Bennings, is 38. He is 38 years old when he made
this. Are you kidding me?
He was born in 1944, so he is 38 when he made this. And he, I can't, wow. It's not like he looks old or bad for it. He just doesn't look 38 to me. So these guys just have these lived in faces.
Wow.
Yep. Yep.
That
there's
going to
be a
mind.
Couple more that are even more troubling. but yeah. Yeah. Here we go. It's okay. Now the first goddamn week of winter. And by the way, Kurt Russell, of course, was friends with John Carpenter, had already done two projects with Carpenter. He had played Elvis in the miniseries, the TV miniseries for Carpenter. And he had played Snake Plissken in The Empire, Escape from New York. But he was only 6 years out from being a Disney star still. He was still doing Disney movies in the early 70s. And yet here he is as the toughest of the tough guy. And it's... you know, that's hard to do. A lot of actors don't get that chance. They don't get a chance to flex their muscles like that. But
yeah.
Carpenter saw something in him and put him in, you know, again, cast him as Elvis and then made him Snake Plissken. And then he did Used Cars and did some TV work. And now he's MacReady here. Here we go. Now there's Thomas Waits as Windows. I came here to reach anybody. You want me to reach somebody? Now, all right. Now we're setting up. We are cut off. And here's now this. I've always thought this scene here is Knowles talking to those two guys, but he's not. This is separate. He's talking to the guys in the rec room. So that feels like there was some dialogue that was missing or something. I'm not sure what he's responding to exactly.
Yeah, that's true. There's a couple of little moments like that in here where the editing might have been a little wonky, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they probably just cut a line of dialogue out. Like I said, that's TK Carter as Knowles. Bullshit, Buana. I love this little, here you go, the guy Palmer. I think he's been there, gives him the middle finger there. That's David Clennon as Palmer. I knew him mostly from when he was on 30-something. He played the head boss of the ad agency or whatever company they worked at. And he was like the yuppiest of the yuppies in that show. And here he's Mr. Wasteoid Hippie, which is, again, he managed to play against type. So good for him. You know, that's great. He got to do something very dear. I love this. I'll give you the lift. Forget
it,
Palmer.
He's great in this role, too. He's great in this role.
I love that. Thanks for thinking about it, though.
Actually, the casting across the board is incredible in this film.
Oh, yeah. This is marvelous. Marvelous bunch of actors. David Clennon was 37 when he made this movie. I know he's looking up MacReady's. I love that MacReady kind of doesn't really want to do anything. You know, he whines a lot about having to do his job.
Yeah, he's very curmudgeonly for how old is Kurt Russell, did we say?
He was 35, I think, when he made this film.
30. He's a curmudgeonly 35-year-old.
Yeah. I was too, but I mean, I didn't look like him. But there you go. I love his Kutcher griping MacReady. That's great. You want to fly? We don't fly. Okay. Now, that's Donald Moffat, I mentioned earlier, as Gary, who was ostensibly the leader of this group. He was 52 when he made this movie. So, again, I am only 2 years younger than Gary. So, I feel very old.
Wow.
Yes. I like that line.
I don't know if that should make you feel good or bad.
I don't know.
You know what I mean? It could go either way.
I love that line from Palmer where he says he knows what he's doing. So right there, we get the sense Palmer likes MacReady. Like, you know, he's the whatever alliances might exist here in this group. He's on MacReady's side. You know,
I also love how the camera panned down to the dog, you know, kind of a little nod to the dog under the table tennis table.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't know, you're kind of like, why are they showing me the dog so much? Like, what's that have to do with anything?
Yeah.
They're not, you know, just like, all right, it's just a dog. What's the big deal? So, all right, he's going to go take off here and they're going to go see what the hell is going on here. The 50s film is really good, I should say. But this movie puts the lie to, you know, the whole thing about, oh, they shouldn't remake good movies. They should remake bad movies. Well, sometimes you can remake good movies too. Because, I mean, I like the 50s one a lot, but oh, here we go. I love this. Will you turn that crap down? I get sleeping shot today. He's talking about Stevie Wonder. What are you talking about, Ben?
Stevie Wonder? He should have been shot for that. for turning down Stevie Wonder. Just shoot him again, maybe.
One of the greatest songs ever recorded, Superstition. What are you, Bennings? What do you listen to, Lord?
That's one of my favorite Stevie Wonders.
Oh my God, it's great. When this film originally came out on cable, that song was replaced. They couldn't afford it.
What did they replace it with?
I forget, but not as effective. I remembered seeing it going, what? Is that the song? You know? And then, or maybe on the VHS. There's some version where they couldn't afford. Here we go. Right here, this is my favorite shot in this entire movie, is this.
Love this. Yes. So good.
And incredible, as John Carpenter points out in the commentary, incredible acting by a dog. I mean, it stops. Oh,
this was, yes.
It looks. It gets close. It doesn't look at the camera as they're so pulling good. Back, and then it stops, closes its mouth, and then heads in. And then this poor guy, whoever that is, and then he's gonna what? Boom! And then we know something's wrong. Now, do you, in your mind, do you know who that is? Who do you think, which one of them that is?
No, you know, because at first, no, I don't know who that is. Honestly,
I always assumed it was. Charles Hallahan is the actor of it, Norris, because it looks like he has that kind of bun hair a little bit, but we never know. We never do find out which one of the guys that is, but that scene is just so creepy because you're just like, what? Why does the dog looking? And just again, the way it stops and it closes its mouth, like it's, you know, focusing on something. It's, oh, okay. I'm going to go in and get this guy. And it's happening, you know, way away from everybody else, obviously. I like it. The use of the music is great, where we can hear the song, but it's way off in the background. So we know wherever this camp is, you know, it's pretty far away from where anybody else is. So whatever is happening, they don't know about it. So.
And what I love about this too is it's kind of a precursor of things to come, right? Where we're seeing the Norwegian camp now.
Yep.
And it's a hint of what lies ahead, which I think is, I love that. Now, here's a question, because you talked about remakes. If you had the power to remake any horror film, what would it be?
Oh, Lord. Oh, wow. I got to think about that a little.
I'm trying to think about it.
I got to think of, like, what horror movies, like, again, I tend to say, why not remake something bad? You know what? I think my initial answer would be to do another pass on Invasion of the Body Snatchers, just because every three of the four versions of that film are really pretty good. There's the 50s one, that's a classic. There's the 70s one, which is a masterpiece, the one with Donald Sutherland and Leonard Nimoy, by the way, your favorite, Leonard Nimoy.
Yes.
That's a masterpiece. And then the one in the 80s or 90s, Body Snatchers, that's pretty good. There was one with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig, which I did not see, which supposedly is not very good. But that story, I think, is so durable that I could see them doing that again. That might be something worth.
That makes sense. Tackling. Actually, I didn't even know there was a Nicole Kidman version.
Yeah, well, that was.
Maybe it's not even worth seeing.
Apparently it was. It was not. It's not very good, and so I never bothered with it. But the 70s one is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. The one with Sutherland and Brooke Adams and Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, that's a great movie.
So Richard Dysart here. As Copper, he was 53 when he made this movie. So again, I'm only 3 years younger than this guy. but yeah, they're seeing what's in store for them here is what the hell happened in this place. Now, all of this stuff is the last stuff shot for this movie, because all these sets are the sets of Outpost 31 after they were detonated.
Oh, wow. So it really is full circle.
Yep. Yeah. So this is like the end of the shoot, this whole sequence, because at this point they blew the set up and they, you know, they obviously.
Oh, I love that.
It. Yep. This is
that
all.
That makes sense.
This is all them at the end. Here we go. Now this is this guy. How would this even work? The science that you would bleed. You'd be bleeding out your wrist, but it would freeze while it was still dripping. I mean, how does that even. Scientifically possible, but you know, okay.
You know what? It looks cool. So
it looks cool.
We won't question it.
It looks cool. But look at this. Look, it's gorgeous. I love all the holes in the set. I love for a color movie, this is essentially a black and white sequence. I mean, there's no color here virtually at all, except for the red of his blood.
Yeah, the lighting is incredible. I mean, we get this little, yeah.
I love that. I love all the holes punched through the wall here. The music, again, the music by Morricone is just fantastic. Just absolutely eerie and weird and kind of sciencey. These guys are like, what the hell are we looking at? Portable video unit. Video.
Portable video
technology. Stuff is still in paper. Stuff is still on paper. It's all in Norwegian. I love that running gag about the Swedes. They're Norwegian. He's always correcting MacReady about things. They're just Norwegian. Here we go. This is great. He's going to discover this. What the hell? What the hell? What did these guys do? Now, have you seen the sequel / prequel that came out like about 10 years ago?
I did not.
It's okay.
I think I'm a bad movie watcher in the fact that if a movie gets panned and is you know deemed not good by whom, I don't know, but the majority of people pan a movie, I won't watch it.
Okay.
And I've probably like missed good movies because of that. You know, like, cause like you said, The Thing wasn't some big hit.
Yep.
But, I have such a short attention span, Rob. Like I cannot sit through a bad movie. We watched a really bad movie last night and I just got up and started cooking dinner in the middle. I couldn't handle it.
Do you want to say what the movie is?
I will. It was old.
What is it? Oh, M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Yes.
Oh, you didn't like that? Okay. I have not seen that. So, okay.
Okay. Well, I won't say anything. But,
okay. Yes. I know you are famously a harsh, you know, you are not, I don't know if you have a short attention span. I think you're being hard on yourself. I think you're just, something has to, you have to get into it. And then if you don't, you're like, I'm out.
Yes. You know, maybe that's
just,
it.
Yeah.
Maybe I just have high standards. I don't know if that's a very becoming trait either, but. But, you know, like I've said before, I will tap out of a show, you know, I tapped out of Breaking Bad in like season before, you know, I don't know what season it was, season 4 or something. And people are always amazed. Like, how do you tap out of that show? You know, I'm like, I can't handle him anymore.
He was almost
too good of an actor that I hated his character so much, you know, but he's such a great actor.
The dog is watching what's going on.
Now, do you want to hear a fun fact that I know about Antarctica?
Absolutely.
Did you know that Arctic means bear and Antarctic means no bear?
I did not know that.
Because okay. There are bears, there are polar bears in the Arctic, but there are no polar bears in Antarctica.
Okay. Right. See? I did not know that. Okay.
That's a fun fact for you.
All right. Yeah. I love
bears.
There are
no polar bears. I know.
I love too. This prop. This prop is
just so good.
Rob Bottin, the great Rob Bottin, who was about 22 when he made this. I mean, he must have been an interesting kid that he had. By the way, here's Gary's butt. Gary's got a nice butt. Donald Moffat.
He does have a nice butt.
Keeping it tight.
And he's got a bandolier. Yeah, the bandolier.
Looking pretty slick.
Yeah. I think a bandolier improves buttage by at least like 60%, right? Because it looks cool. Let's be honest. A bandolier looks cool, right?
I wonder if Chewbacca might have that same kind of bandolier in those movies.
I don't know. The hair might reduce that percentage for Chewbacca a little bit. The buttage.
Now there's Joel Polis is Fuchs there, the kind of assistant scientist. He was 31. When he made this movie, born in Philadelphia, by the way, it's local hero, Joel Polis. The most famous role that I know Joel Polis from outside of this was he was a recurring character on Cheers. He played the owner of the rival bar, Gary's Old Town Tavern. So he would show up every season or so and, you know, put Sam through his paces and stuff like that. Every time he showed up, I'm like, oh, it's Fuchs from The Thing. I was always so excited to see actors from The Thing show up in other projects. So
that's now where I know him from.
Yep. So now he's all right. Now what the hell? What are we? Oh, they love the great that dog watching all this. Yeah. reading an old photo play mag again. There's got to.
I know. I love that.
Pre-internet. There's just nothing for these guys to do. I mean, ping pong. Some pinball. There's some board games. They have videotapes to watch, but man, once you've burned through it all, it's nothing new, you know? I mean, I guess they bring supplies every so often, but.
Even today, I mean, even if you had internet and you're down there today. I mean, okay, here's a question, Rob. How long could you last in Antarctica?
Oh, you know, not long.
Even with internet.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, what do I have to do? I mean, do I have to work? Do I just stay down?
You just stay down there. And let's say someone's going to pay you $1,000 a day. How long do you think you
would last? $1,000 a day?
Yeah.
I could probably last a little. If the internet existed, that would probably be pretty easy. I would think that'd be pretty easy. It would be pretty boring, but I think I could hack it. What about you?
I don't think I would last. If I'm by myself, I guess it depends on who I'm with, you know? Mm-hmm. If I'm alone, I don't think I would last a week, probably.
Really? Interesting. Okay. No, I'd record a lot of podcasts, I guess, you know? I mean, although I guess my Zoom connection would not be great in the Antarctic, but 1,000 a day, I might be able to stick it out for a little while. As long as, again, I didn't have to go out in it, you know? Now, here we go. Now, they're watching. The guys are watching. Let's make a deal.
Let's make a deal, yeah.
Now, this was something that when I appeared on the Thing Minute podcast, I always thought was I was the only person that thought this, and then Harper agreed with me, was he puts in this other tape, right? And we don't see what's on it, although it flashes for a second. But we hear this weird music, this kind of, and I always like, did they put on a porno? Because it has a kind of porno music, and Harper agreed with me that he thinks that that's what they did. They put on a porno.
You know what? Dan and I, when we watched this the other night, I said the same thing because he assumed it was porn, Dan.
Okay.
You know, but that could be his own bias. No, but I said, is that what it was? Because it did sound kind of, you know.
All right. Well, okay. Then clearly I'm not crazy, because everyone now that I've mentioned it to has said the same thing. So obviously,
yes,
that's probably what they were intending. There's something about that music, especially with the wah at the end, you know. Oh, by the way, here, Bennings doesn't like the dog. The dog walks by. So Bennings doesn't like Stevie Wonder or dogs. So he's just useless.
He's on our list. Yeah, he's on our list.
He's just
here.
Useless. Here is Richard Mazur, of course, as Clark. Probably, you know, if I had to pick the personality closest to me of the 12 guys, I would say it's Charlie Clark. He wants to spend time with the dogs.
I love Clark. Yeah.
Richard Mazur, again, famous actor, appeared in One Day at a Time as a regular on that show. He was in My Girl with Macaulay Culkin. He was the president of like the Screen Actors Guild for a long time, too. But he's been in a million.
I think he was in License to Drive as well. Remember that movie License to Drive that Corey?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, Corey, the Corey's movie. Yep. 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 Yep.
I had a big Corey Haim thing.
He was 34 when he made this movie, Richard Mazur.
Wow.
Yeah. He was actually at a monster convention, like, you know, Horror Con last year in New Jersey. And we were going to go to it, and then COVID really got even worse, and a lot of people canceled, so we didn't get to go, which is a damn shame, because I would have loved to have gone up to him and you know, to get a picture with him. Because I have...
That would
have
been amazing.
I have a picture of the cast signed by Keith David. My friend Dan Colon got it for me. He went to a MonsterCon and got the picture signed to me by Keith David, plays Childs. So my goal is, you know, every time we say, oh, here we go. This is this awful. Now this, yes, I can't stand to watch this. These poor dogs. This one dog is so scared.
Oh, I know. It's terrible. I hate that part.
I wonder what they made that fence out of so he could chew. That's why, like, can't, you know, like cotton, you know, candy something or candied sugar or something like that. But these poor dogs. Oh.
You know what I love about Clark? He's such a great character in this because it feels like there's something off with him. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, he's got this vibe going on through the whole thing.
Yep.
Which I love. I know. That's so sad. With the, poor pups.
But anyway, I was going to bring the picture that I have autographed by Keith David to the convention to get him to sign it. That way I could just start collecting as many Thing signatures as I can. But unfortunately, again, COVID got in the way of that. So maybe he'll come back to a show one of these days and I'll get to do it, because I would love to. Love to shake his hand and just say, hey, man. I mean, again, I'm sure he's heard about this movie from every person at a horror con, because that's why he's there.
Well, yeah.
But here, now the monster. Oh, the one dog gets away. The one dog's like, I'm out of here. Me too. All right, we're done. Oh, this is so. Ugh. This thing is just, what the hell? What am I? It's dark in this place. I guess they got, because they need to conserve their energy, conserve their generator use.
You know what's occurring to me now? You know, whenever I teach writing, I talk about if you take away a scene, then it probably doesn't need to be there. Mm-hmm. So here's a question. Like, the beginning sequence of the spaceship crashing,
mm-hmm.
what would happen if that went away? I don't know if it would take away or add anything. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, you don't really need it.
No.
You know? I mean, it's nice to have it. And that it's like, okay, this is most definitely something that landed. It's not something they just found. But you don't really, you know, they don't, the fact that they never answer it. You know what? That's a perfect segue. I mean, you write a lot of books, and what do you think of this as a story construction by Bill Lancaster? By the way, son of Burt Lancaster, the famous actor, Bill Lancaster. I mean, this is a pretty solid screenplay in terms of building suspense.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's a pretty, it's a airtight story.
I agree. And the you know, you don't know who you can trust mentality feels organic, because you don't necessarily get the sense that there's already tensions, I think, among them, you know, that have been established. So it kind of grows from that, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is horrible. This dog.
Oh, this dog, this poor dog.
Oh man, this is so gross. The special effects are one of my favorite things about this film. I mean, you know what I think about too is like, I know.
I think that drives Clark. He can't stand.
I know.
That would be me. Oh. I would be like, I know what's happening, but don't shoot my dogs. Come on. Oh. I love this. I love that we're going to get this disgusting. Those guys, they look there. They're just like, what are we looking at? Like,
what disgusting.
What the hell? And then it just disappears into the ceiling. They're just like, oh, okay. Well, now we got to deal with that. But yeah, I mean, like you said, Clark, you know, Clark seems to be a red herring. He seems to, you know.
Yes.
But of course he isn't. We find out that he won't be. And the people that we don't. Oh, look at, oh my God. Oh,
that is so gross.
There we go. Just melt it. Just set the whole thing on fire. There you go. Yeah. It's just, oh, but yeah, I mean, he said the screenplay is in this version. And again, this is, you know, Carpenter talks about this on their commentary, is that this is more an adaptation of the book, the short story. I read the short story, Who Goes There? And this is more of, I mean, this is a lot more visceral, but it has that same kind of thing. The 50s version is a more sanitized version of it, because there's nobody in the 50s version, the monster doesn't assume other people's forms. He's just a monster that's loose in this camp. But in this story, it's the monster continue. There we go. He's cracking it off like he's at a Red Lobster here.
I know. Oh, gosh.
Look at that thing.
That is disgusting. I'm really making a face. You can't see me, but I'm going to see. And what's funny is, for someone who loves horror movies, I always hide my face. Like, you would think I'd be, you know, down to clown with the gore, but I'm just like, oh, it's so gross.
Now, I love that he's like, look at, he's cutting into this thing. Ugh. He doesn't have a mask on. He doesn't have... Like, you know what I mean? Like, how do you know that, like, touching this thing, some goop isn't going to come? Look at, like, he's like, it's right up in it. How do you know that some giant pustule isn't going to shoot out in your face? You know, he's got operating gloves on, but that's it. Yeah. Like, good Lord, they're not really, I mean, they don't know that these things aren't dead yet.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. They don't know that, but still, I wouldn't get that close to...
Trust me, I wouldn't be anywhere near that room. No. I would be in the shack, the Kurt Russell shack.
You're up there writing your books. Just up there.
Yeah, I'm just like, don't involve me. I don't want to be involved.
Yeah.
In fact, you can lock me away, you know, just like they do to him in a little bit.
Now, there you go. Now, he just put the eraser up to his mouth, and that was the eraser that had just touched the goo thing. So, yeah, look, he's poking that thing. They are not worried a whole lot about
He is not socially distant from this thing in any way.
Again, these are great composed shots. I mean, we get, you know, I mean, he's getting a lot. Look at that thing.
Yeah.
We're getting all these actors in the shot and seeing what's going on. Oh, now the poor. Yeah. I love that. Easy, easy. Like, he's, you know, Clark's still.
I know. I love the dogs.
He really cares about the dogs' welfare. I guess that's why you need a guy. I mean, if you're going to have these dogs, you got to have somebody who's like a dog whisperer.
So there you go. That's his job. So, you know, he's the dog guy.
He's the dog guy. Strange. Huh.
I love this. It's starting to all this.
Yeah.
You know,
now it's beginning. Yeah. I don't know.
Starting to get in there.
Wandering around the camp. It's the way he just says things so flat. You know, no emotion.
So good.
I don't know. Hour and a half. It's just so quiet.
His little one-word answers, you know?
Yep. An hour.
Short sentences.
Maybe. Yep. They love that. What are you looking at me like that for?
So good.
Great. I don't know. I mean, nothing. Yeah, it's happening now. We're all not trusting each other. You got to wonder, like, how much of these guys know each other. The only reference we get in the entire movie is later on where Gary will say that Bennings is my friend.
I've known him
for 10 years. That's the only sense we get. These guys have ever known each other outside of this. So imagine that. Imagine being deposited with 11 other people that you haven't met in this location for however long. Good Lord.
Yeah, because you think about it, like, you know, as the movie's getting started, you see that they're, you don't get the sense that they're, you know, a close-knit family here.
No.
You know?
No.
They obviously kind of tolerate each other, I feel like, which makes it even better, you know, because then the story can build off of that dynamic.
Did you get any cabin fever when the lockdowns happened? I mean, God, this is kind of, we all just went through this a little bit. Now, obviously, we were not as locked down as these guys are. These guys literally can't leave. But did you start feeling that a little in the initial parts where you know, nothing was open and you had to kind of just stay at home?
I did. I did. But you know what? I did write a book during that time. And you know what helped is just knowing that everyone was kind of going through it. Everyone was going through the same thing. It was like a strange comfort, you know, because you're like, okay, well, it's not just me.
Yeah.
It's everyone. So that kind of puts it in perspective. What about you?
Yeah, I don't get that way generally. I find that I can, you know, there's always stuff for me to do, you know, there's a podcast to record, there's movies to watch. I just don't get that way. I mean, I like being outside, especially when it's nice out, but that just doesn't get to me a whole lot. There's times where I've noticed, I'm like, geez, I haven't been outside this apartment in 6 days, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, and it just occurs to me. I was like, all right, I'm not feeling cooped up or anything. I mean, maybe if it went on a really long time or I couldn't go exercise or something, maybe I literally couldn't leave. But yeah, no, it didn't. Like you, I realized everybody was going through it. So it was like, well, some people have it a lot worse, so I'm all right.
And it was worse. I think it was worse in the winter, at least for me, because at least in the spring and summer, you can go sit outside or take a walk or whatever, you know.
Yeah, when it's dark at 4 o'clock. You know,
are you a fan of Seinfeld at all, Rob? Because
I watched it at the time. I haven't seen it since, but I watched it when it aired.
Okay, well, there's an episode, because you know Elaine works for the J. Peterman catalog, and she writes copy for an item of clothing called the Urban Sombrero, and it's completely what Kurt Russell is wearing here. So
that hat, yeah.
Everyone needs to Google Urban Sombrero, and you'll see that Kurt Russell was ahead of the fashion times.
That is a hell of a hat. That is a hell of a hat. First of all, great matte painting here, this spaceship. I mean, I go on and on about matte painters because it's a lost art. Nobody does matte paintings anymore. But, I mean, these people were geniuses, just geniuses that you could paint this thing and it fits in with – look at that. Look at
how big that ship is.
Oh, my God. Now, I will say, I feel like this scene is the only part that I would say that I have a little bit of a problem with this movie. At all is that they've just discovered a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a big deal. And the scene just ends. Like, we don't get the sense, did they go in? Did they study it? Like this is huge. This is a huge thing. This is the first time in the history of this universe this movie takes place in that there is conclusive evidence of alien life. And here it just fades out. And we end up, you know, here they discover the thing, literally, but like, that's it. There's no commenting on like, well, what did they go in? Did they look around? Like, it's a spaceship. I think it's kind of a big deal.
That's a good point. Although, you know, they kind of have bigger fish to fry right now, right? What with the monster.
And they
have limited time because they have to leave before Sunday.
Before it gets dark. That's true. That's true.
You're right.
And I don't know if I want to see them go in the spaceship necessarily, because that happens in the sequel. They actually do go in the spaceship, and it does kind of ruin the effect a little. You're like, well, now I'm seeing the thing. It's better to just imagine it. But they kind of handle it amazingly well, that they've just discovered a spaceship. Like, kind of, not one of them goes, wow, you know, like, oh my God.
Maybe they're too manly to react. Maybe Rob, so. You know, maybe. They're
yeah, look, Chariots of the Gods, man. They practically own South America. Palmer's totally a member of QAnon now. We know that. Totally. Totally a QAnon shaman. We know that. Here they found the pieces here. And we still, again, this is, you know, for an actor, for a director to have a shot with 12 actors in it and keep it all in frame and keep everybody, you know, kind of get the sense of everybody. It's hard, you know? Yeah. I mean, geez. I love this. And put your dirty doors in a trash can. So there, now we know what Knowles does. Knowles is the cook. So, okay, that's why he's there.
See, it's all coming together.
It's all coming together. Get Gary's in charge. I love this. I love his, what do you want from me? Like, I like that Mac is the natural leader and they all turn to him, and yet he doesn't want to be the leader. He's, you know, talk to Blair. Blair's the guy that should know. And of course, Blair is understanding that. Here we go. Now this is some
high technology.
Yeah, this is amazing. You know, it's so funny. It's like, you can make fun of this because it looks like Pong, but at the same time, it tells you everything you need to know.
It does.
You know what I mean?
It
you don't need
does.
Any more than this.
It does. It really does.
There we go. Yeah. Okay. Takes over. Duplicates the cell. Finishes it. Okay. Now cell dog.
Imitation.
What's it going to do? It's going to go and take over the other cells. Okay. Well, got it. All right, thank you computer. And this is the same technology that Brundlefly uses in the Fly, where it can tell you a lot of things that a computer probably shouldn't be able to figure out, but that's okay.
The only thing missing is Majel Barrett's voice.
Yeah. Computer, hello computer. Now here we go. Now how can the computer possibly know this?
Yes, I know.
But okay, that's okay.
But it's effective. It's effective.
Oh,
but
it's very creepy. Yeah.
What is he typing in? You know what I mean? Like that the computer can spurt out this information.
Yeah. Here we go. Now it reaches the civilized areas. Dot, dot, dot. Entire world infected in 27,000 hours. Now that is 1,125 days. So that is roughly 3 years. So they're saying in 3 years, the entire world will be contaminated. So that's pretty bad.
That's not good. It's not good.
I like the jar of white out there in the drawer.
I was just about to say that, yeah.
There is MacReady with drinking up the last of his.
And finessing someone's dirty underwear.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting choice.
Mm-hmm.
He's got beer and whiskey. He's double fisting.
Yep. I love the blue gel light on the door. It's just it's beautiful to look at. It doesn't make any literal sense. Like, where would that light even be coming from? But it doesn't matter. It looks cool. It just looks really neat. But yeah, so 27,000 hours. Blair is the only one that understands the enormity of right now of what they're facing. He's got his gun. He knows something's... And, you know, so much of this is going to take place off camera. I mean, at this point, the next time we see Blair... he's basically gone nuts. So all this stuff is happening off camera while we're watching this. This is great. I love this. Can we go out? I just want to go to my shack and get drunk. Can we talk in the fire call? Can we go outside? It's 40 below outside. It's 40 below. It's a reasonable thing to say. It's 40 below. Why do we have to talk outside? Now here's this little, Now, this gag, this thing of a creepy body that somebody is in the room with, and it moves, and they don't notice that it moves, or maybe it does.
Oh, he's so good.
Carpenter steals this from himself, because there's this exact same scene in The Fog where Jamie Lee Curtis is in a room with a cadaver, and she doesn't notice the cadaver under the blanket is starting to move.
It's yes,
the
it's
same
so
gag, good. But it works every time. You know, here, I love that. There, the
that's one of the creepiest moments, honestly, I feel like.
I love that.
When we see it, yeah.
And I think the windows is just about to... There, that's great. Did I just... See? No, I didn't. Okay, it's fine. And now it's gonna... There we go.
Yeah.
Oh, that gelatin
that's
is going to start...
That's disgusting. I'm making the face again, you know. We got more buttage. We've got a butt shot.
Yeah, there ain't more... Yeah, Bennings is... There you go. Now they're gonna talk out there in the thiacol. Now... As I said earlier, the dog scene is my favorite scene of the movie, but there's a moment here that I just think is, I mean, Kurt Russell's, no offense to Kurt Russell, not known as like a great actor. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's not Jack Nicholson or like a Meryl. I don't think he's ever been nominated for an Oscar or anything like that. Obviously a great movie actor, but just, you know, I don't think he's known for being particularly, you know, like the top of his field. I don't mean to be insulting. He's a great star. But anyway, I'm sorry. There's a choice that he makes here that I think is very subtle and I think tells you everything about this character, where here he's saying they're not dead yet. Now here, right here, there. I love that his eyes, his pupils kind of flash down. And in that moment, he understands what they're facing. I'd love that just in that little moment. Ooh, look at that. That's messy. Oh, here we go. Now we're going to get our first real gore effect of what happens to you when you're taken over. And, no!
And don't you love that effect of when you see the actor's reaction before you see what they're reacting to?
Yeah,
that's always so effective.
Do you think you would ever be compelled to write a horror story? Do you feel like you have that in you, or you just enjoy it and not?
You know what? I've tried, and it's just not. I think it's just not my voice. You know what I mean? Because I love to read horror as well, but. For some reason, I just don't, I'm not great at writing it.
Oh, you read a lot of horror as well?
I do. I read a lot of, thriller, a lot of horror, a lot of, you know, all that stuff. Mm. In fact, when I teach a short story workshop at Rosemont College, and, I'll often include horror stories in there because also from a storytelling standpoint, I find horror really interesting just to, oh, this is very freaky and disturbing. Because you have to really utilize a lot of storytelling techniques, you know, suspense, tension, what the reader knows versus what the characters know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can learn a lot about it in general, I think, from horror movies, storytelling.
Do you get scared at older horror films? Are there any ones that are like, I mean, of course, at this point, this is considered an old movie. But I mean, I'm talking stuff from like the 40s and 50s. Have you ever seen a horror movie from that era that genuinely scared you? Or do you feel like, you know, the style is just so removed, you can enjoy it, but it doesn't scare you?
You know, that's a great question. And I think, you know what, I'm going to say The Changeling freaked me out a little bit.
George I'm Scott.
Yes, I can't remember what year that was. Was that the
80s? 79, 80, something like that. Yeah.
There were moments of that freaked me out. But I think
that's a creepy movie.
I think it's because I tend to be creeped out by ghost things, which is ironic because if you ask me if I believe in ghosts, I'd say no. But maybe that's not true because they scare me. So I don't believe in them. Why would they scare me? You know?
Yeah, Aaron, come on. Examine that in yourself a little. Come
I know.
On.
I need to. I need to. But for any listeners who like to read horror, one of the short stories that I teach is Heading Home by Ramsey Campbell. It's a horror short story. It's very short, and it's told in second person, which makes it even, gives it an even creepier vibe. So if you like to read horror, you should read it.
What is, I feel so ignorant. What is second person? I forget what that is. I know what first second, and third is, but what's second?
Second is you.
You know, like, oh, okay. That's
you,
unusual.
You walk up the stairs, you open the door, you know, this kind of thing.
You don't read a lot. You don't read a lot in that style.
No, it's very hard to master, but it's a great short story, so I recommend it.
Now, they just asked, where's Blair? So, okay, everyone's out here, but Blair's no Blair. So that's ominous that Blair is not watching this. And then there was the line about where Gary says, I've known Benning for 10 years. He's my friend. And great line read by Donald Moffat in that he is the leader of this troop, but he is not equipped. He cannot wrap his head around what is happening. And just the kind of pathetic way he says that. I've known him for 10 years. He's my friend. Like, that doesn't matter, Gary. Get with the program. And we now know that it's MacReady he's up to speed with what's happening, and Gary is not. And I think that's great. Again, it's great from a storytelling point of view. That's terrific because it reminds me a bit of Alien, the first one, where, you know, we assume that Tom Skerritt is going to be the main character because he's the most famous actor. And then through process of elimination, we of course learn that no, Sigourney Weaver's the main character, but we don't know that as the film rolls on. We keep thinking she's going to get killed because she's not that famous.
Yes.
And then, you know, she keeps lasting. Here, I love this. This is creepy. You're like, who's that? What the hell? Why was somebody? What, Blair? What's that? Why was he there at the helicopter? What's that about? Yeah, that. Oh,
this is another storytelling thing. Is, you know, one thing that I love about horror movies that makes for great storytelling is how can we make things worse for the characters, because that's what amps up the conflict and, like, you know, provides a lot of the foundation for your story. So they have no radio communication, and now of course
they can't even get away.
Yeah, their helicopter's all jacked up now.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's frightening in that Blair is doing this for the right reasons,
right?
But he's not cluing the rest of them in on it, which is not a great idea. You know, maybe.
Correct.
I mean, yeah, he doesn't know who he can trust. That's
right,
why he's
exactly
doing it. But it's still not great, because now, of course, he's putting the whammy on himself by acting nuts. And now everyone thinks he's, you know, here we go. Here we go. This is great. His dialogue, when you can read it as a subtitle, is fantastic. Where he's just, you know, Clark's got a knife. Gary's got a gun. And he's just destroying shit randomly with his axe. Think about those computers there that he's smashing. My phone has probably 1,000 times more processing power than the room full of machines he's got here.
Yes.
There's a Windows, no help at all. Now, right here, we're going to see this hand, like, right child, right there. That hand is a fake hand. Keith David broke his hand in a car accident while making this movie, and they had to put a cast on him. And his arm is in a cast, his left arm is in a cast, and that glove is just a fake hand, which is why he's kind of babying it like that. But yeah, that's a fake hand. But you don't notice it because he's got the glove and it looks sort of natural. Do you think that thing wanted to be an animal? No dog's making 1,000 miles through the cold. I love this. That they wanted to be ass. That's a great. If the cell gets out, it can imitate everything on the face of the earth. Okay, well, that's pretty much it. I love this. Yeah, I kill you. And then throw the gun. Why not? Sure. This is, it's scary getting hit by an axe. It's pretty terrifying.
Pretty smart bringing that card table over there. Block the axe blow.
Oh, there we go. Now they're going to pile. Bam! There, he gets a good shot. I think I love, there's one thing where, here, you're going to see Fuchs just fall out of the frame in a second. In 1 second. Here, watch. She's going to just, there. Whoa! Just falls out of the frame. I don't know what happened there. He just got, wah! There's Clark watching.
The dogs, not the dogs.
That's awful. Yeah. So I asked you, what do you find scary? And it's like, I find, you know, stuff pre, I don't know, I'd say the '70s doesn't scare me anymore. I just think the styles have changed, but you know, there are exceptions. And I told this story actually to Harper when he was on the Film and Water years ago. There's a Twilight Zone episode called "Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up?"
Yes.
Which is actually very much like The Thing, because it's about a room full of people in a snowy diner, and one of them is an alien, and everyone is suspicious of one another. And I had never seen that episode until I happened to watch it the night before I was going away to school for the first time. So I would have been 18, 17. And I watched it, and I had never seen the episode, and it genuinely frightened me. And I have to think that, even though it's from 1963, it's black and white, and it's, you know, it's a little cheesy, or watch Clark, watch him close. But it genuinely unsettled me, and I have to think that was because I was about to embark on something I had never done before. You know, I'd never lived away from home. It was literally the last night in my childhood home, and I have to think that was, you know, on my mind, obviously, and then seeing this story. But I remember watching it and being really pretty scared, and then being impressed that a Twilight Zone that was 25 years old could still scare me. So that's my favorite episode of the Twilight Zone is, and I know you love that show as well.
Oh yes, I know. I definitely know all the episodes. That's a great one. That's definitely a classic. And I love the episodes like the monsters are due on Maple Street, yep, where it has this mob distrust mentality, and you know how he played with that in the show, and that's a big aspect of The Thing, obviously, mm-hmm, which I just love that, you know, because it adds a whole nother layer of suspense and tension to the whole thing. And you know, you bring up a good point, because I think the things that scare us, you know, in horror movies, obviously it depends a lot on what we're bringing to the table, what we're bringing to the film, you know, mm-hmm, like I have home invasions tend to scare me more than mm-hmm any kind of gore or anything, you know, because that's a thing that's scary to me. So you watch that at a specific time, and it affected you in that specific way. And I think the thing with movies like The Changeling and The Others and, you know, these ghost movies, I think what frightens me is the unseen, you know, the fact mm-hmm that you can't see it. Like with The Thing, you can see it. Of course, when it shapeshifts, you don't know, you know, what the hell you're looking at. But, you know, you can see the monster there. But when it comes to ghosts or the paranormal, you yep can't see it. You know, and that's creepier to me, I mm think.
This is gonna be a moment here that is my favorite. Not my favorite. I already said my favorite was Kurt Russell with the pupils, but there's an actor's choice here that Richard Dysart is going to make that makes me laugh so hard every time I see it, because you could say it's an actor that is, he's kind of dialing it to 11, but he's not. I think it's the character is dialing it up to 11, not the actor. The actor is not overacting. The actor is playing a guy overacting. So here he's going to, where they're talking about who has the keys. Anybody get the keys from me? Here he goes. I don't see how. As soon as I finished, I return it right away. Boom. That look. It's such an exaggerated look to Gary of like, okay, Gary, it's you. I give it to you right away. And it just kind of looks at him like throws the blame onto Gary. Like, okay, all right.
Side I love eye that. Gary.
I love that. I love it. By the way, you notice that the Dr. Copper has a nose ring?
Yes, I know. Hip
for an old guy.
That's very hip.
A weird detail to have a doctor with a nose ring. You don't see a lot of that. Here we go. Now they're supposed to clear him. Now they're all getting mad at each other. And now, of course, Windows, not Frosty in the clutch, is going to lose his mind. Going to go get the guns.
Now, do you think you would lose your mind, or do you think you would be calm? You know, like
with this situation?
Yeah, like, would you be a Windows, or would you be a MacReady?
Oh, I'd totally be Windows. Oh, my God. What are you kidding? I wouldn't be able to handle this. What are you, nuts? Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I would be gone. I would be hunched under a table somewhere. I would just, like you talked about, I'd go into the shack and just be like, leave me alone. I could not handle this at all. Good Lord, Aaron, I get nervous. My hands start to shake when I feel like, I'm getting close to the end of the workday and I haven't got my work done. I get so nervous. So no, I would not. This would not be advisable. You know what? I mean, the closest I can get to that is when I did my live version of Pod Dylan, which you were at. And, I was terrified. I was nervous the whole day. And I was just standing in a room full of 30 people. I couldn't take that pressure. So speaking of not being able to take pressure, this is great. Gary is okay. He's officially standing down. And then he says, somebody else is going to charge. And then he says, Norris, I don't think anybody objecting to you. And Norris, with a great bit of self-actualization, I'm not up to it.
He's like, I'll take a hard pass on that.
I love that Norris is like, no, pass, can't do it. Nope. It's great. I love that a guy, you hand him the keys and he's like, no. And then Childs wants to do it. And they're like, no. Somebody a little more even tempered, Childs. You can't put Keith David in charge of things. That's nuts. He's going to kill everybody. He can't do that. Now, you've spoken in front of lots of people. I mean, you teach as well, but you've spoken in live situations in front of, dozens, hundreds of people at this point?
I think the largest crowd is 2,000.
2,000?
Yeah.
Now, are you okay with that? I mean, you do it, so... How do you get nervous?
Sometimes I get nervous just before, but I really don't get that nervous anymore. Good. It kind of gives me an adrenaline boost.
Wow. Okay.
But I think it depends on what, if I had to talk about something that I don't know what I'm talking about, maybe I'd be nervous, but I feel like I'm so passionate about writing and publishing and books that I guess it just amps me up,
I could see that. Yeah, that's true. I guess if somebody asked me to talk about podcasting, I could probably do it. But I said I got nervous and I was talking about Bob Dylan. I mean, good Lord. But here, I like this is now MacReady has come to this conclusion. Some of you must be human, because if you were all the thing, you would just kill me. And so, okay, now he's got to, now he says, I know I am human, and we're going to learn pretty soon that you don't know you're human. And that is one of the creepiest elements of Bill Lancaster's screenplay, is the idea that there are people here who are infected but don't know they're infected.
Yes.
And that's a great wrinkle to throw in. Most horror movies don't have that. When you're the monster, and you're pretending. But there are some people here who are infected but don't know they are. And that is, so MacReady can't know that he's not the thing, but we don't know that. And it makes sense. You would say, oh, okay, he knows he's human. But yeah, obviously some people are human, because then the thing would just be, hey, we're all the thing. It's all good. Now, there's a great
moment I love this.
Here where he's recording the tape. None of us make it. It's got a record. Russell's great in this movie. I didn't mean to insult him earlier. He's tremendous in this part. I mean, the way MacReady ramps up, getting acclimated to this ridiculous situation and the weariness and just the, what the hell am I going to do?
Well, and I don't think you were insulting him earlier, but I think what you said makes sense. Like, yeah. He's a good actor. He's just not kind of known for whatever reason, as he's not like the Tom Hanks or the.
Yeah, Jack right. Nicholson. That was right. That was all I was trying to say. Is that in the great, when you ask people to list 10 great actors, they'll list Anthony Hopkins, Jack Nicholson, the people that get nominated a lot. And he's not one of those guys. But, he's been a star for a very long time, and he's delivered a lot of great performances, this among them. I mean, this is really one of his best. Now, here he's go back. Remember, did you used to have one of these things?
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? It's such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. Did you used to keep a tape in the stereo, and then you'd run and press record if one of your songs came on the radio?
Oh, absolutely.
To make a mixtape?
Yep.
I mean, times were tough back then, right? With the play and record.
Yep. You had to really, you always missed the first 5 seconds of your song.
Yeah.
I love that Carpenter put the camera behind MacReady there as if someone was watching him during that recording.
Yes, I love that too.
And this shot here, or the shot they just had earlier of Fuchs and MacReady, is a, as they call it, a split diopter shot, where it's two pieces of film stitched together, because you can't have both. Yeah, this is a split diopter shot where they're not in the same shot at the same time. It's put together. It's two different pieces because you couldn't focus on both actors at the same time. So it's, and then you hide it by some sort of vertical that you can put in there. And the, right, of course, the darkness makes it a lot easier. Brian De Palma does a lot of that. But now this is creepy, the way the lights just go out. Fuchs handles this pretty reasonably. Like, okay, lights are, like, I'd be pretty terrified.
I know. I mean, at like, this
Jesus.
Point.
And here's an old-timey monster movie scare. Boom! Who's that? And the fact that that person did not respond to you, I'd be like, oh, shit. That was the thing.
You know, me too. Could... Those always get me every time. Those jump scares. Yeah. I mean, I'm a sucker for those.
Look at the lighting on this. This is gorgeous. What a beautiful... Dean Cundey, the cinematographer. Gorgeous. Just... all blues except the red from the flare. I mean, it's just a beautiful, you know, poor Fuchs. He's going to get it. We don't see it, but he's going to get it. So this is the second of the, and then there were none kind of thing there. Oh, shit. What? MacReady?
Dun, dun, dun.
That doesn't sound, that's not, anybody see Fuchs? Oh, thank good. We were talking earlier about things that we find scary. I find, you know, you said you find ghosts. I find cult movies to be really scary. The notion of like the nightmare town, like the idea of somebody wandering into something and like everyone's in on it except our protagonist. Those I always find very unsettling. I always find it very creepy, the idea that there is a group of, I love this, cut the bullshit. He's just had enough. Cut the, they're like little kids, you know. I don't want to go with him. I don't want to go with him. But I've always found movies about that to be very frightening, of just that the idea that you could have 5, 10, 20 people in on something so nefarious and they keep it a secret.
Oh, that to yeah.
Me is very frightening.
That so, is creepy. Yeah. Yes, that's creepy.
That's always, to me, I hear that. That's all right. I'm you know, I'm like, I'm halfway there, you know, to scare me if that's the setup of your movie. Have you ever seen a movie called Dead and Buried from 1981, by the way?
No.
Okay. You should check that movie out. Yes. It's written by, I love this, great detail of Blair. Hey, Blair, how you doing? And then we get to see, we get the reverse shot here of Blair, the noose.
The casual noose.
The casual noose. Blair's like, well, I might need to kill myself. I'm just sitting here in the shack eating canned beans. This is, what a great detail of the noose. It ain't Fuchs. I'm not going to harm anybody. Nothing wrong with me. Yeah, okay. The noose really suggests otherwise, Blair, that,
yeah.
that you're doing okay.
I'm raising a suspicious eyebrow at you, you know, Blair, with your...
Wait a minute, man. I want to come back inside. Don't you understand?
Why would you want to come back inside? I'd be just in a little hut by myself.
Hey, everybody, when you guys fix this whole alien invasion thing, come get me. Other than that, I'm good. I got my beans, got my Photoplay magazine. I'm fine. But anyway, Dead and Buried. It's from 1981. It's written by Dan O'Bannon, who wrote, or Ronald Shusett, who wrote the original Alien movie. And it's a great, lesser known, very creepy horror movie from 1981. So you check that out.
I think you will enjoy it.
I have not known anyone that does not enjoy that movie. They haven't heard of it, and then they recommend it, and they go, oh, geez, it's really good. Now, that makes us bring up something very awkward. We have to talk about it, Aaron. Is that you screened this movie for your your partner. My future best man at my wedding, Dan, and he was not as impressed with this movie.
You know what? Afterwards, I just said, I'm not suggesting any more movies, because this was like a couple years ago. I said, we're going to watch Aliens because that's one of my favorite movies of all time, right? Aliens. I mean, who doesn't love Aliens?
Masterpiece,
right?
Of a movie.
We watch it and I'm like, wasn't that great? And he says to me, he kind of just shrugs. It's like, it was a good movie, but it wasn't great. And for some reason, I stayed with him, Rob. I didn't leave him right then and there. I don't know why.
As soon as I find a new best man, I'm going to do that. He's out. He's out.
And then he said the same thing about The Thing. He's like, it was a good movie, but it wasn't great. That's wrong. You know,
he's literally the only person I've ever heard that doesn't love this movie. Literally.
I mean, yes, exactly. Exactly. Now, he did like some scenes in it, but he thought it was slow. And I don't know. And then the other day he said he wanted to watch Rosemary's Baby because that's on my list of favorite horror films. And
yes.
I thought, if you think this is slow,
oh my God,
you're
yeah.
really not going to like Rosemary's Baby because talk about a slow burn.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, no, I do want to see it. So we're going to see what happens when he sees Rosemary's Baby.
All right. And he can, another bad opinion coming from the maker. But all right. I still love the guy, but that's just disappointing. It's very disappointing. So here. Norris is going to find. Now we're going to. There. Ooh, oh, he's got a chest pain. Now that is the proof that you don't know you're the thing, even if you're the thing, because we know at this point from having seen the movie that Norris is the thing because his chest is going to collapse in the next scene. But if we know he's the thing, but if he isn't the thing, well, no, we know that he is, right? We know he's the thing at this point. So, but yet he's having chest pains. If he was faking that, he wouldn't need to fake it because there's nobody else in the room.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah. So he does not know he is the thing. So therefore you don't know you're the thing, which again, terrifying.
Yes. Even more frightening.
Yeah. There, Nalls. I cut him loose. Now, some of them are less upset about this than others. Now, yeah, anytime, anywhere. If it did get to him. Now, yeah. Now, child seems a little bothered by it, but maybe not. And Windows, where were you? Then they get those two. Oh, he's squabbling.
I mean, honestly, but Creedy said earlier, oh, I love this.
The door knob.
So good. Yeah. Said that child wasn't even tempered enough, but he's not. I don't find him to be a hot-headed at all. He's kind of chill.
Yeah, he's doing all right. Yeah. Yeah, actually.
I mean, everyone else is freaking out more than he is.
Although here, this isn't great, where he says, Childs, what if we're wrong, man? Then we're wrong. Well, that's all right. I mean, you know, you probably need to keep all the human allies you can, Childs. I don't know if you want to. We know that he doesn't like MacReady. So
that's
like
true.
This is a big loss, but still.
But the information he has, you know, he's got the somewhat proof, which obviously is not fail safe, but
yeah. As they say, sometimes you got to lose a finger to save the hand. So maybe that's Charles.
Although you'd probably want to keep more humans rather than less humans, like you said.
Here we go. He's cut the door down. This is great. MacReady looks.
Yes.
Look at that. It looks great. Effect. He looks like a wax statue of himself with all the white highlights and stuff. He looks terrific. Gonna blow that. No, I don't know why do they need to have dynamite at this place, but okay, they do. They have it. Back off, man. Way off.
Kurt Russell's so cool, is he not? Is he
Yeah. There's a scene coming up where there's the big explosion, and there's a you, if you see it, you'll notice there. Oh, there they almost get him. They've like, I love the way he kind of falls backwards. I love like it's yeah, man, just relax. You just tried to kill me. What are you talking about? Oh, there's Norris. Oh, yeah, that would be me. That would be me probably. I would probably be having a heart attack at this point. Yeah, he's not breathing. Yeah.
I think maybe I'd be like Clark. I'm just like in the background taking it all in.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
I love Gray. I love that he's gripping his hand like he's getting over being cold. Yeah, this is.
Oh, this is good stuff.
Oh man, we're gonna
so good.
Oh, this is so foul. This is so. I love this here.
I know, it's awesome.
He's got this great line coming up about the and they're looking at the scalpels. That might Clark's thinking. You got to sleep here. He's about to say, you got to sleep sometime, McCready. Here we go. Yeah, I love. I'm a real light sleeper, child.
This is a great shot here.
Oh, man. Yeah, there. Like, see, there. You can see the scalp. Clark's. The one time Clark goes outside his comfort zone and he's going to get a bullet in the head for it. So
that's the lesson. That's a shame.
Here we go. Here's the big whammy effect. There we go. Blammo. Oh my God. Now right there. No, right. Oops. There is another. That's a actor with missing arms. It's just for that one shot.
So yeah.
Faked it. And here we go. This is just. Now, again, I talked about this when I did the Thing Minute with Harper, where this movie got panned by a lot of critics, like Pauline Kael and a lot of the kind of, you know, higher end Tony or critics. And, you know, You know, it's easy to look back at them and say, oh, well, you know, those fuddy-duddies didn't know. They couldn't appreciate this stuff. But if you were someone that grew up on classic Hollywood filmmaking, what are you supposed to do with this? You know what I mean? If you're somebody
that's fair, I guess.
No, yeah. If you were someone that was older and grew up on classic Hollywood and had been going to New York Times, you know, parties your whole life, and then there's a movie where a severed head grows into a spider. What is your reaction going to be? You know, no offense to Pauline Kael, but is Pauline Kael really going to be someone who's like, oh, I love it when the tongue comes out and drags the severed head across the floor? Is that really her jam? I mean, come on.
Although, you know, the question is, just like with books, and when you're learning how to write and reading like a writer, the question is, was the filmmaker successful in what they were trying to do?
Yes.
And I think it's absolutely yes, you know? So
oh, completely. Completely. Yeah.
That's
and that's
the
always
thing.
Right. I always thought that's how you judge something. Is it, you know, does it hit its target? And if it does, then it's effective.
Yes, but, exactly. Even if it's not your jam. Did it do what it intended to do? And no one could say that the thing did not do what it intended to do.
Look at this. Oh, my God. What, again, what was in Rob Bottin's water growing up as a child?
There are so many things going on here, yeah.
Right. This is the big laugh line of them just watching the little thing.
He's like, later.
David Clennon's great. You've got fucking kidding. Even after all this, they still have the capacity to be shocked at some of the inventive transformations the thing is capable of. My God. But I mean, you know, it's like I mentioned, other than Dan, who has no taste, you know, I've said no one I've ever seen dislikes this movie, but you got to know your audience. You know, like when I show my parents this movie, no, of course not. They're not going to like it. You know, you got to know that it's got to be the right audience to appreciate this movie. You can't show
that's a good point.
People. You know, you don't want to show this to an 8-year-old. It would send them into therapy, for Pete's sake. You can't.
Now, when you were in elementary school, when you were a little Rob, did you watch a lot of horror movies?
Yeah, I did. I liked it. Yeah. I mean, a little kid, no. But by the time I got to be 11 or 12 and I could select things, yeah, then I did. Then I absolutely did. There's a story I've told many times about, here we go. This is Clark is going to try.
So good, yeah.
Clark is going to, one time Clark is going to try something. Blammo. That's it for Clark. And he was not the thing. So
yeah,
that murdered him.
Poor Clark.
Yeah. There we go. This is bullshit, Mac. Again, they're touching dead body. Like, how do you know that? Yeah. Things are safe to touch, but okay. But anyway, when I was 7, there was a trailer for a movie called Magic with Anthony Hopkins, where he plays a ventriloquist whose puppet comes to life, or at least he thinks it comes to life. And the whole trailer is just the puppet talking. And at 7, I was utterly terrified of that trailer. It just sent me into hysterics. And it was in the 70s when it ran. And so, of course, you know, that was pre-remote control. So you had to, like, get up and turn the television off.
Yeah.
And my parents learned, oh, if that was coming on, turn it off. And I'll tell the very quick story. So I was watching Star Trek, the original Star Trek. My father and I used to watch the original Star Trek together on Saturday nights because they would rerun it. And because my mom would work on Saturday nights at this department store. And so my dad, it was like the one thing my dad and I kind of did independently of my mom. She didn't like Star Trek. So we watched Star Trek together. And so we're watching Trek. And, oh, right on the thumb. Why would you cut it on, like, the forehead? The thumb's really going to hurt.
Yeah.
Oh, can't hold anything after that. Why would you? But anyway, we're watching Star Trek. Commercial comes on. My dad goes upstairs to go to the bathroom, and they play the magic trailer. And I just started screaming in terror. Oh. And I ran upstairs, pounded the bathroom door. And my father must have been like, what? Like, what could have happened in the last 10 seconds since he came out and he had to console me because I was so unprepared for looking at that puppet talking.
I'm going to have to definitely look up that trailer now.
It's not a great movie. It's an okay movie. It's not very scary, but the trailer for a 7-year-old, it was like, whoa, no. So yeah, the trailer's on YouTube. You can find it, stuff like that. So here we go. MacReady with his dubious science. What else are you going to do? But I mean, how do you know that blood does anything if you put a hot needle on it? How do you know? I wouldn't know.
This scene is incredible. I love this. So I remember sneaking into Nightmare on Elm Street in the movie theater.
Oh, wow.
And it came out. Yeah. I forget what I got tickets for. And then I snuck in. Now, even Dan had to admit that this whole sequence with the blood was so well done.
Yeah.
I mean, the suspense.
Yeah. I found out, again, I keep mentioning the show, but it's really good. The Thing Minute, I found out from the host, Harper Harris. If you look here, everybody that is going to get tested, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody has a pin light in their eyeballs. Except Palmer, who we're going to find out, of course, is the Thing in a moment. But he does not have a...
Yeah,
I never noticed that. Look at that. See, everyone has the pin light in their eyes, and that is the tip-off. They are human. But Palmer, the way they lit him, they hit it. So he does not have the light in his eye, and that is telling us something's off.
I love that.
Yep. Yeah, I never noticed it until I did the show a couple of years ago. I'd seen this movie 10,000 times, but I'd never seen that. He's got the light. Now, there's the fake hand. He's already introduced the fake hand, so we don't notice it. Again, a great misdirect by John Carpenter, who we have not talked about enough about so far in this commentary. This is the genius of this movie, is him. But the mystery, see there, no light. Gary's got the lights.
Oh, love that.
See, there you go. But I love
that's the attention.
There's the hand.
To detail.
See, the fake hand. We're like not even looking at the hand now. All right. It's still right. Whammo! Oh,
and what's amazing is you're just getting comfortable, you know, with the whole, the dialogue's happening, and then you're like, oh, shit.
There we go. Palmer's gonna...
This whole sequence is...
Oh!
Oh, no! Whoa. Oh, boy. Imagine and they're all tied together, which I love.
Oh,
yeah,
my God. This is so... This look at this. Like, what am I even looking at? What is that? Look at that. Oh, my
shit.
God. Now, he's going to hit the ceiling with such velocity that the little debris is going to go the wrong way, too, as if they flipped it upside down. But, okay, now, Windows again, not Frosty in the clutch. Come on, Windows. Don't just stand Windows. There.
Well, like, what are you doing?
Too late.
Yeah.
There we go. That's it for Windows.
Too bad, Windows. You know,
look at
Windows had a certain charm, but now he's getting eaten, so that's a shame.
Look at this. Just waving the body around. Look at this. Oh, my God. And then poor MacReady with his bad flamethrower. Come on! But, yeah, I mean, Carpenter, this is just directed within an inch of its life, this movie. You know, I mean, just any given scene is... This is great. This flame effect. This poor guy. This poor stuntman. buried in the thing. I learned again that the danger of doing this kind of stunt is not the fire. It's breathing in. If you breathe in, you will breathe in fumes and you'll rip your lungs apart in about 3 seconds.
That makes sense.
That's the danger, not the actual, that, because you've got all this gel on you. Here we go. Look at that. That almost knocked Russell off his feet because that explosion was bigger than they expected. And apparently a bunch of debris flew by Russell's head. And there is audio of that moment. And Russell's like, holy shit, guys, what just happened? Boom. Like, he's like, he was just like, he like wet himself a little because the explosion was way bigger than they expected. This is bad. Oh, that Windows, all those board games.
I know, that's the real tragedy, because he already destroyed Chessmaster.
Yeah.
Now they can't even play these board games.
Yep. No more Ribbit or whatever it is they're going to be playing. There now. Now, how did, like, did they
back
put
to
the fire
experiment.
Out?
Yeah.
Like, did they put that fire out? This is kind of a big deal. But yeah, I mean, Carpenter just, and it's such a shame because this movie kind of was a failure. As I mentioned, it came out in June of 82. E.T. was on the march as it's the massive hit it was going to be. And, you know, I mean, man, what a summer. June of 82, Star Trek II, E.T., The Thing. I mean, that's a bumper crop of movies.
Not to mention Poltergeist.
Poltergeist. Yeah,
excellent
another
film.
Another masterpiece. I love this. I love how calm Gary looks. Okay. I love three of them standing there. But yeah, but then, so, you know, Carpenter was kind of in movie jail a little bit after this for a while. And that was part of the reason that he did Starman, which I think is a great movie. But he did Starman because that was a nice movie. He wanted to prove that he could do kind of a nice movie. He didn't just spend the rest of the time tied to this fucking couch. But that was the reason why he wanted to show Hollywood, hey, I can make movies that are not just, you know, a kick in the gut over and over again. I can make something a little nicer. And Starman was a success. It was a financial success, and Jeff Bridges got nominated for an Oscar for it, and they made a TV series based on it, and it kind of got him out of that, you know, little movie jail a little bit. But yeah, this
I gotta be honest, I forgot all about that movie.
It's a terrific movie. I got to meet, when I met Karen Allen at a con a couple of years, I got her to sign my Starman Blu-ray, and I got the
oh, nice.
Yeah, I love Karen Allen. Just absolutely love her.
So here's a question. If you're a filmmaker, would you prefer to release a movie that has mediocre success and then just fades away, or release a movie that bombs and then later becomes a huge hit, like, you know,
oh, geez,
10 or 15 years into the future after you've been in movie jail?
Oh, boy.
If those are your choices.
Oh, Lord. That's a real Sophie's choice there. I mean, well, hey, I can turn that right back on you. I mean, what would you say about, how would you feel about one of your books not being a big hit, and then 10 years later, someone's like, oh my God, this thing was a masterpiece. I mean, how would you feel about that?
Oh, that's a good question. You know what? I almost want to say I'd rather just have mediocre success, because that's a rough 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where everyone thinks you're a flop and a hack.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, I think I'd be bitter by the time that 10 years was up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd be like, oh, now you like my movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Part of me would be bitter, I think.
Yeah.
It'd be hard not to be bitter.
Yeah. How could, I mean, you know, all the work it takes to make a movie, just any movie, the amount of effort, people and lights and, you know, sets building and all, and then to have it get released and have people revile it. I mean, one of the critics called John Carpenter in relation to this movie a pornographer of violence.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a pretty bad review, you know, because, and now you look at this movie and you say, well, this thing's a masterpiece. This is again. Now, again, luckily Carpenter still with us. He went on to make a lot of other great movies. Big Trouble in Little China is a, you know, terrific movie, and Prince of Darkness, and In the Mouth of Madness, and you know, things like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, he never matched the success of Halloween, what he had right out of the gate. But yeah, I would imagine it would almost be better to maybe have mediocre success and continue on, as opposed to dropping a bomb, which could kill your career, and then, you know, you don't get to do that anymore. And then it's like, yeah, it's great that 10 years later they've rediscovered it, but that doesn't help me now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But all this is terrific. All this scene setting he's doing here, all the shots of the hallway. Look, we've never even seen that doorway before. Where's that go? Yeah, it's all these empty, you know, all these rooms are empty. I mean, you get, again, the feeling somebody is the camera the thing? Is the thing looking? Is that what we're seeing? Or is this omniscient? What's going on? But yeah, now we're down to just a couple of core people. Again, the lighting of this is, look at that. Oh, that's.
Yeah, it's so good.
Just, we're in the middle. Look at who's now. Who the hell's that?
That's another thing that's so disorienting, right? It's hard to tell who's doing what and who's who. And
that's, I mean, again, one of the great ideas of making a movie in an atmosphere where everyone has to be covered up. You know, you put it in the desert, everybody's running around and they're a lot easier to, you know, the lights are going to go out. Oh, yeah. Look at that. And then the emergency generator lights. Oh, it's so creepy. Now again, MacReady is the only one that really understands what is going on. He's accepted and he's about to tell them we're all going to die. There's no way out of here.
Yeah.
The rescue team finds it. The last thing, what do we do? Yeah. He's thinking, you know, Gary's still thinking there's a way out of this, but MacReady is, you know,
Here's a question. Like, okay, if the thing wants to freeze, what's to stop it right now from just like scuttering away a safe distance and going in the ice?
Yeah. I mean, that there is no way. That is the one thing they have to kind of hand wave this move away, is that there is no way to know you've killed the thing. Because if the thing can break into a million pieces, then why can't it just sever part of its body and, as you say, scutter off and go to sleep and let everyone think that it killed it when it's asleep? You know, it's like, oh, no, I'm over here. So, yeah, you can't. There's no way that anyone can know that it has been killed for sure, because, you know, it can survive. And, in fact, you know, there is an alternate ending to this movie. Well, there were two alternate endings, one of which I've never been able to find. One is where they do rescue MacReady and bring him back to a station and they test him and they find that he is in fact not infected. And they shot that, and apparently they even showed it to somebody in some capacity. I don't think it was ever in like a actual finished version of the film, but it was shown to somebody and then they just said, no, it's a cop out. The movie's got to end in the camp. It can't end with
bonus scene. Agreed.
But the other end scene that is available, and you can find it on YouTube, if you look up thing deleted scenes, is after the camp explodes and the smoke, we cut to the next morning and we see the camp is smoldering and it's nothing but wreckage. And we see the dog running away from the camp, heading off into the snow.
Oh, so, interesting.
You know, they're right there. He's telling you the thing did not get killed. It infected another dog. I mean, you know, how do we know that the thing has not jumped in one of these dogs? And as you say, the dog is just sleeping somewhere, just staying out of the fray, waiting till everything kind of settles down.
I think I like that ending, because that kind of gives at least a little acknowledgement that the film knows that you know that we don't know the thing is dead. Mm-hmm. Because MacReady is saying, let's warm things up a little. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, does that really even do anything? I mean, well, they have to do something. But, you know, I feel like it's important to recognize that that could be totally pointless.
Yeah.
But I guess,
mean, again, he's thinking that we can kill it, that it only exists as one creature. But we know that that's not true. So. We saw it jump into the ceiling from the dog kennel, but then they still had to deal with it. It was already in Norris at that point. So yeah, the thing can duplicate itself. This is all terrifying.
Very terrifying. Actually, the ending is what was one of the things that, Dan did not like. And I was so frustrated because I love the ending. I love when things end, because to me it's more terrifying. It's just kind of ambiguous. But he's the kind of viewer that wants answers, you know, like he wants,
right.
He wants it to be finite, but I mm-hmm. think that the ambiguity is better. Cause I feel like those kinds of endings have more trust for the viewer than the ones that wrap everything up. Does that mm-hmm. make sense?
Yeah, completely. I mean, some movies I want definite resolution, you know, but for this movie, I like that it is ambiguous because that's part of the horror of it. The creepiness of it is like, you're just like, is this, I mean, how bad is this thing going to get? You know, I mean, is it going to go on and on? I mean, so yeah, I, that's part of the reason I love it is that it does have that ending. Again, other movies I would be probably not satisfied. But for this set, I've always thought it worked. I can't imagine anything else. You know, I can't.
Yeah,
like the scene of the dog running away is not bad, but, you know, I mean, like there's a novelization of this based on the original screenplay. Now, I've not read that, but it does exist. And apparently in the novelization, like in a minute, we're going to see Knowles, the last of Knowles. And we never know what happens to Knowles. He just disappears. In the novelization, they explain it. They say that they explicitly show Blair getting Knowles. And Knowles, before he gets whammied, kills himself. And that seems like a fine scene, but I liked it. You know, this is bad. Oh, this effect is so bad. Ooh, the fingers in the cheeks.
I know.
That's just the fact that it took about a second and a half for that to happen. It just looks so painful. You know,
yeah,
it just looks like
it does not look comfortable.
Oh God. And then there's going to be this one split second scene of Gary with his face all gooey, like it's made of a chewing gum. Right. It's coming up right there. Oh God. Oh, well, it does remind me a bit of Aliens, where they inject themselves in you, but you still live for a bit. And it just looks, you know, hell on earth.
There's quite a few things in this that remind me of Aliens, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, and there's Knowles is going to...
He
just wanders off. And yeah, I could see there would be, you know, in the book, you have to explain more because you got to fill the pages, but... I think this is better that Knowles just wanders off and obviously he gets killed. And I love that it takes MacReady a minute to kind of realize that. How's it coming out? How's it coming in there? I said, and then, oh shit.
Yep.
Yeah. That's just great. Yeah. It's like, oh boy. But yeah, that's something else that frightens me is the idea that the monster getting you would take a while. You know, it's one thing if a slasher, you know, cut your head off. Well, it took a second and a half, you know, it's terrible, but it was over. But the idea that like Blair sticks his fingers in your cheeks and slowly convert like that probably took 10 minutes to happen. And that would be so like it's like an Aliens when they discover that woman and she's whispering, kill me.
Yes.
And then the alien pops out of her chest and you're like, oh Lord, this poor woman has been in agony for how long? Like that to me is, that's just, you know, that to me is really terrifying. Now here's this. Yeah. I mean the thing, there we go. This is great. I love it. Grabs the tentacles. Going to grab the plunger there.
Yeah, he's like, never mind. Cancel.
Oh my Lord. Look at this. Oh, no. Look at this thing.
That's not cute.
And there's the dog still. There's a dog in there. Oh, God.
Yeah. That's disturbing.
Yeah, that is just... There we go. He's going to pull somersault. Yeah, a little bit of some action stuff there. I think here's the... This movie's central thesis. Fuck you too.
That's the line in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that MacReady doesn't have anything more clever to say than that. He's not a wordsmith. He's just like an alcoholic helicopter pilot. All right. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Too.
He's not a Renaissance man.
No.
He's no poet.
And here we go. Just blowing up the camp. This is it. I mean, you're committing yourself at this point. If you're the filmmaker, that's it. We've blown it up. We can't. No more shooting of these scenes. This is it.
Could you imagine? Like, oh shit! I forgot to press record.
We didn't get the. oh shit, we didn't get that scene. We gotta piece that together now here. Now, I, you know, a bunch of times that I've watched this movie, I forget that Childs is gone. You know what I mean? Like, I don't remember it now because I've seen the movie so many times. But it works so well that you get so caught up in the ending that you kind of forget that you don't know what happened to Childs until this moment. When he returns, you're like, oh, yeah. Forgot about him.
Yeah. And it's so great, of course, the two adversaries,
yep,
you know, together at the end, naturally.
I love, he looks like, yeah, he has been through a lot. Is the fire now, and we're going to see Childs show up in a moment. Now, you do got to wonder, what was he doing this whole time? Yeah. Yeah, of all the two people, of the two people that you don't want to be stuck together, if these are the two. And look, I think he doesn't answer Childs' questions. Did you kill it? Where were you, Childs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, they're like talking past each other, but not... Childs is being extra creepy. If Childs wanted to, he could really put MacReady's worries at rest a little bit, but he's being extra creepy. It's just the way he's talking.
But he also doesn't trust MacReady, so he's being cautious as well.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So
yeah, neither will no. Now people have talked about that there's the reason that you see MacReady's breath a lot here, but you don't see Childs's at all, is that that's a tip off that Childs is the thing. But Carpenter himself, probably tired of being answered these questions, has said, no, that's a flaw of the lighting. That was not an indication of anything. That's
well, I mean, if you're putting pin lights in people's eyeballs, it makes sense that people would assume that, mm-hmm, to take meaning in,
yep,
the fact that there's no breath there, you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah, right. Once you invite that kind of scrutiny, then you have to, people are going to go nuts and look into every little thing. Because they even talk about that, like, there's a coat missing at one point, and that's Childs' coat, and it's blue. Like, his Childs' coat is blue, and here it looks gray, and you're like, well, wait, why would he change his coat? But then, again, Carpenter has said, no, that's the same coat. It's just covered in snow, and the way it was lit doesn't look blue. So, yeah, he's
now, has he said definitively one way or another?
He refuses to answer. He says he knows, but he won't answer, which is
that great. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
why,
of course.
Why do it?
Right,
yeah, why? Yeah. There, here we go. Let's just see what happens. No.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And he has that little chuckle. Okay. And then.
How do you like to think of this ending? Cause I like to assume that neither of them are the thing and they just freeze to death.
That's always been how I've taken it. Yeah. That neither one is the thing and they both just die. The thing is survived.
Yes.
But they are, neither one of them is the thing. And they just die. They just freeze to death. That's it. I mean, what else is it? I mean, nobody's going to come rescue them in the middle of the night. You can't fly choppers in Antarctica in the middle of the night. And they can't last. As he said, it's 40 below. So you can't be out there for an hour, you know? So yeah, they're just both going to freeze to death. And presumably the choppers are going to arrive and they're going to go, what in the holy hell happened here? And maybe the dog is running around, but
What? I'm surprised you didn't mention Wilford Brimley's age as we were going.
I thought
ages.
I did. I didn't want to go, but yes, Wilford Brimley. Wilford Brimley was 48 when he made this movie. I am 2 years older than Wilford Brimley. In the thing.
I mean, I think that's more of a compliment to you than it is, you know, a statement on age itself, right? Because
I appreciate that.
I feel like Wilford Brimley, you know, if you just saw him in this, you know, I would not guess his age at 48.
No, it looks so
not
much
even
older.
Close. Not yeah. even close.
Yeah. If somebody had said, I was like, he would probably be like 60, 62, 63, you know? Nope. No, 48. People just looked older back then. Just did.
And then in Cocoon, because Cocoon was 1985.
Right?
Three years later. He's like 52 or something
in
Cocoon. Sorry. What?
Well, I will, not to get off the thing as we're wrapping up here, but again, one of these like weird age data points is yesterday we were watching the Sex and the City reboot series.
Yeah, right.
And And Just Like That, it's called. And people are pointing out that the women on that show are older than all three of the Golden Girls were when they started their show.
Wow.
And of course, you know, we think of that a little differently.
So true.
But nevertheless, we think of aging very differently now than we did in the 80s. But so, I mean, that's the thing, everybody. I mean, it's just one of the great horror sci-fi films of all time. Not that John Carpenter needed, after Halloween, even needed anything else kind of to, and Assault on Precinct 13, which is a great movie, needed anything to really burnish his reputation. But this just, I mean, he had a run in the 80s like nobody's business. You know, Halloween and Assault on Precinct 13 and The Fog and, Escape from New York, this, Christine, you know, Big Trouble in Little China, Starman. I mean, that's an incredible run of films. And, you know, I keep hoping he'll still want to make a movie one day. He's still around. I keep hoping that some, you know, a Guillermo del Toro or a Quentin Tarantino, who's just a fan of his, will, you know, here's $60 million, John, make a movie. Just make your movie. Yeah, I'll executive produce. You don't have to deal with studio. I'll just make your movie. But I think he's like 80 now. He might just be like, the legacy's intact. I don't need to make another movie.
Well, maybe he's doing a MacReady. He's like, I just want to sit in my shack and get drunk.
I think so. He does music. I mean, he's out doing tours of his music and stuff. So he's still active, but maybe just making a movie anymore just is not into it anymore. But that's, by the way, the credits here, production illustrators, Michael Ploeg, one of the great Marvel Comics artists of all time. Michael Ploeg did a lot of horror work. And he did some of the character designs for The Thing. I always like to notice that name as it goes by because I grew up with that guy. He was one of the guys I definitely liked as a kid and the artist whose style I recognized. So, Aaron, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this movie. I mean, especially for this kind of thing, it just goes by in a heartbeat. You know, I mean, there's just so much to say about this movie. So thank you for doing this. Anything else you want to wrap up with as we're getting the last couple of seconds of this movie?
No, just, you know, thanks for having me. You're right. It did go by fast, didn't it? But that was great fun and still an incredible movie, no matter what Dan says.
Right? It's just so frustrating. Again, I got to find somebody else to be my best man. Once I get that straightened out, I'll let you know. Right. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
So you could find me at AaronEntradaKelly.com. And I'm also on Instagram and Twitter at AaronEntrada.
All right. Very cool. So, everybody, thanks so much for listening. Of course, you can find back episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be named checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to big time movie producer Corey Musa and David Gutierrez and Gord Tolton for their support of the Fine Water Podcast Network and this show in particular. I very much appreciate it. So everyone, let us know in the comments what you thought of our commentary. I love doing these. They are just so easy to do. I just have so much to say about these movies. And it's especially fun when I have someone really fun joining me. And that was in the case here with Aaron. So again, everybody, let us know what you think of The Thing, what you thought of this commentary, if there's anything else we left out. Again, leave us a comment over at findwaterpodcast.com. So that's going to do it. Again, Aaron, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a blast to podcast with you.
Yes, thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you. So, all right, everybody. So we'll be back with another episode soon. But until then, that is all.
I don't know about copper, but I give you my word, I did not go near that blood. I guess you'll all feel a little easier if somebody else was in charge. Norris, I can't see anybody objecting to you.
I'm sorry, fellas, but I'm not up to it.